Welcome to Rolling Starts. My name is Justin Nicosi and I am the host for this fascinating series. I speak to successful business leaders from all walks of life who tell me about their professional and personal journey so far, including how they overcome tough barriers to get where they are. In this episode, I'm delighted to say we are speaking to Davinia Tomlinson, the founder of Raincheck, an organization that aims to help women build financial resilience and sustainable wealth to live the lives they love. She tells us how she quit financial services to launch her own business that's become so successful. Davinia, absolute pleasure to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us on Rolling Start.
Hey, Justin, thank you for having me.
You famously have walked away from the City of London to launch your own business. What drove your passion to set up your own business?
Growing up in the family in which I grew up in, and, you know, very, very traditional immigrant Caribbean family in which education was at the heart of everything that we did, and a feeling that we had to be constantly striving for success. That has definitely, I think, you know, the hallmarks of that are almost etched all over everything that I've done in my career. My upbringing and my background was perhaps one of the driving forces behind that. So I suppose, first of all, if you start from the position of, you know, we talked about me coming from a very traditional Caribbean background, lots of those Caribbean families are very matriarchal. And that's not to say that the men don't feature in those households. They're very much there. You know, I grew up with my dad, I grew up with grandfathers. But the people that have really left a lasting impression on me in terms of their ability, their resilience, their resolve, their ability to overcome challenges, whatever kinds of challenges they might face, have always been the women in my life. So I guess that's the start point. Then when you kind of fast forward through to my career, you know, in the city, and, you know, working for, you know, a huge global asset management firm, and recognizing that even on the graduate scheme that I embarked on when I, you know, fresh out of university, there are probably 10 of us in that year, in that cohort. And of the 10, there were maybe three women. And, you know, that representation was borne out, you know, when you went onto the, you know, the office floor, when you looked at the client base. And then when you go deeper, you know, obviously as a marketeer, thinking about the client base, the demographic of the, you know, the clients that we served, very male dominated. The City of London is a very testosterone fueled world, even today. And of course, that's changing. There's lots of good work that's been done to, you know, redress the balance there. But I think, you know, the germ of the idea for Raincheck, you know, outside of my family, was really born in those early stages of my career, and recognizing that not only did women not seem to have a very representative voice or a seat at the table in terms of, you know, at a senior management level in lots of those big firms, but also we were not represented in the client base either. And so when you see all of the data that swirls around with regard to the gender pensions gap, the gender investing gap, the gender pay gap, all of these challenges that women face financially, I felt like, you know, in terms of me building a business, I wanted my contribution to be something that centered around that. And of course, you know, when we come back full circle and we think about, you know, from a personal perspective, thinking about my family, I'm now a mother myself and I have two daughters, which is brilliant for the brand. It's brilliant for the Raincheck brand, obviously a business that's designed for women. And now I have two daughters, you know, but I think even outside that, you know, the idea that I might be leaving a lasting legacy that in future will mean my daughters won't be having the same sorts of conversations about, you know, women's propensity to save for retirement or the gap that exists between them and their male colleagues. That is really important to me.
You know, you're not a Londoner. We can still just about hear your Brummie twang. Sometimes I get confused. People think I'm a Brummie, which is unbelievable. But what was it like growing up in Birmingham, and who were the main influences in your life growing up?
You know, the number one main influence on my life, and particularly when it comes to the things that I've done, you know, building a business that revolves around womanhood and finance, is my grandmother, my maternal grandmother. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the two of us, you know, I'm the eldest of like a dozen grandchildren, and the two of us were very, very close. We and are very close. You know, she's still with us, luckily for me and my daughters. And I think having somebody that, you know, if you imagine, and it's really difficult to imagine this unless, you know, you can't even imagine putting yourself in this situation. Somebody that would have moved to the UK in the 60s, the early 60s, having left two children behind in the Caribbean. And you come across here, she said it took her, I think, 6 weeks to get here by boat. And then you come here and you don't really know anybody, and you're in these kind of multiple occupancy homes where you're kind of in a single room. And she met my granddad. They had three more children. Then she brought across the two children that had been left behind. And she worked in a factory, as was common then. So this is somebody that was skilled in the Caribbean, but you've come here and you have to do manual work, unskilled work. And she was very, it was that determination, that grit. You know, there's that book about grit. And when I read it, I think to myself, I almost don't need to read any psychological theories about grit and where that comes from, because I have my gran. And I've seen for myself what that looks like. The idea that not only, you know, I know as a mother, what it would have taken for her to say, I'm going to leave my two eldest children there and come across to this unknown place, because we don't have social media for me to see, oh, you know, what does Birmingham look like? What's the climate there? What, you know, are the people nice? What kind of reels or videos are they doing? You have none of that. So you're just basing it purely on your imagination and what you will have seen of the monarchy on those infrequent visits, you know, out to the islands. And, you know, of course, people line up and they smile and wave, and you're thinking, oh, you know, the Queen wants us to come. The Queen wants us to come to England. And you get there and you realize, oh, gosh, what a frosty reception. But it's taken me 6 weeks to get here now, and I can't go back because I'll be so embarrassed. And I wonder whether, you know, that very basic human emotion had fueled so many of the people that stayed, because you can't go back empty handed. And you've got all of these people that depend on you. I mean, she left 12 siblings behind in the Caribbean and parents, and they're dependent on your salary. So, you know, I think being, you know, almost being in the cocoon of someone like that, who managed to build wealth. She was the first person I've ever known to have a financial advisor. And I think the gravity of that, the magnitude of that, for, you know, it would be lost on the average Middle England family here who's based in the home counties and comes from wealth. It would be difficult for them to understand the magnitude of that. But if you consider this person that was essentially having to carry the whole weight of the family, my grandfather was incapacitated due to ill health quite early on. So she was essentially the main breadwinner and was having to do everything single-handedly. Never, she did all, you know, she all the cooking and all the domestic work and everything else. And we talk about work-life balance. That just wasn't a thing for them. They were like, what are you talking about? We just do everything and we get on with it. And I think it really, again, left such a massive lasting impression on me. I think the second person that I would say who was huge in terms of personality, and not because, you know, with my grandmother, it was a very loving, nurturing, nourishing relationship. And even now I'm very babied, despite being the eldest of all the grandchildren. But then my dad, who was a very omnipresent being, huge personality, and was very harsh with me. So it's just me and my sister. My sister is the apple of his eye. Everybody would say that. And growing up, my dad was so harsh on me, and the expectations and the standards that were set for me were so high that, you know, I constantly felt like, you know, I can't fail dad. I never had to worry about, you know, I can't fail mom. It was always, I cannot fail my dad. So I would push myself extremely high to reach these lofty standards. And I think having that, those two kind of competing influences or driving influences in my life have definitely cultivated, you know, the experiences that I've had, some of the success that I've had, but also, you know, helped to shape me as a person, you know, as a Brummie growing up in the suburbs.
You mentioned your grandmother. How old is your grandmother?
83.
Every time you spoke about your grandmother, I was thinking back to my granny, as we called her, who passed away 10 years ago, and the impact that had on my life. You have navigated family bereavement yourself over the last few years. How do you manage to get through that?
You know, over the last 4 years, I've had two quite significant or major bereavements in my life. So the first one was a younger cousin, much younger, who died 4 years ago at the age of 22. It was a massive shock to the family. He wasn't ill in any way. We didn't see it coming. And I remember being, I was halfway through my MBA. In fact, I remember being on a trip, an MBA trip to Vietnam. And I remember calling home and my mom saying, oh, you know, your cousin's not very well, you should give him a call. And this was just, you know, it was something that was so common in and still is very common in my family, that we live in one another's pockets. And I can't really stress, it's difficult to describe it if you haven't grown up in a situation like this. But, you know, my mom has, you know, is one of five siblings. My dad is one of six. And we all pretty much live within a 1 mile radius of one another in Birmingham. So I remember the day my cousin was born. I'm 12 years older than him. I remember the day he was born when we brought him home from hospital. He was just a younger brother. And so his death was such a shock that I remember almost on that very day making a promise to myself and to him that I wouldn't allow myself to hide behind my fears of anything, to overanalyze things to the extent that I wouldn't do them and that I would be frozen with this, you know, paralysis of kind of, you know, overanalysis and everything else that goes with that. And I think it was at that point in 2016 that I decided I'm going to bring RainCheck into existence. It doesn't matter whether it succeeds or fails, but I owe it to myself and I owe it to my cousin to try. And so RainCheck was effectively born in 2017 when I had my second daughter, which was of course a year after his death. In 2019, so just a year ago now, my dad passed away. And I think, again, very unexpectedly, we didn't know that, you know, that he wasn't ill. So, you know, that was a massive shock. And I think it was a particularly, you know, he's very, we were close in different ways. He's very, my sister and my dad are basically, they're like the same person. My dad and I, the relationship that we had was always a very contentious relationship because, you know, I was somebody that, you know, having left the family home, being pushed and pushed by him all through my life, as I've outlined, you know, I was determined as much as I felt like, you know, well, now I can do things my way. I realized, and I spoke about this at the funeral, that I realized that I'd lived my entire life trying to impress this man, this giant figure in my life. And that actually, you know, when I look back on the evidence over the course of my life, there was proof that he had been proud of me the whole time. And so I think, you know, losing him a year ago, what it did was really to help me kind of galvanize all of my inner strength and, you know, all of the lessons that I've been taught over the course of my life about self-pride, about, you know, always, you know, doing my very best and not, you know, particularly if you think about the environment in which I grew up, which, you know, is a very loving, kind of nurturing, extended Caribbean family. I talk about all of these things all the time, but it was also a climate in which, if you imagine Birmingham in the 80s and 90s, you know, I can't really say that I'd suffered any extreme racism or anything like that, but the immigrant mindset is still such that, you know, we're all kind of, we have it drummed into us, you've got to work twice as hard to get half as far, all of these sorts of things. And the one thing I remember my dad always saying to me is, your competition is not the rest of the world, your competition is yourself. So when you think about the things that you want to do, I, as your father, know what your potential is. And so you don't need to think about what society tells you about what a young Black girl with immigrant parents should aspire to be. We will help you realize your ambitions, and all you have to do is commit yourself to being the very best that you can be. And so when I think about the things that I do now, and I think about RainCheck, all I strive to do and all I strive to be is my very best self. So, you know, the people that hear me speak at, you know, conferences or workshops, the one thing that I hope that they will always say is that, you know, with Dav, we know that she's being her truly authentic self. Whether you like what you hear or you can relate to my personality or anything like that, I always think to myself, the one thing that I feel particularly proud of is that if my dad were watching me, he would know that is the daughter that I raised. That is not somebody putting on an act or putting, you know, playing up to the cameras or anything like that. That is who and what she was intended to be.
Thank you for sharing that. Really appreciate it. You clearly navigated that male-dominated environment, and that takes some doing. So I suppose, how did you navigate that?
As my grandmother would say, I'm supremely willful when it comes to things that I want to do. So if I see an opportunity that I want to pursue, or I think that there might be something exciting and I want to get into it, a project or a firm that's working on something or moving in a direction that I want to move in, I will single-mindedly and determinedly pursue that opportunity. And it doesn't matter what noise there is externally from others, from society, from people that might say, that's not the right thing for you. I'm going to fling myself into it and give it everything that I've got until I decide for myself, that's not the right thing for me.
When you were going through your career, were you always thinking, that at some point I'm going to leave the city and build my own business?
I always refer to this film Working Girl, because I'm a child of the 80s and 90s, of course, and I grew up with this film. I remember this, you know, this being completely enraptured by this movie when I watched it. Probably I was too young to be watching that movie when it came out, but anyway, that's by the by. I remember watching it and being so struck by these two powerful competing female figures, and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before, because I think at the time, you know, the role that women would have played in film was always this kind of like a sidekick role, the love interest, of course, but always in positions of subjugation. And it's really interesting how, as a small child, you can absorb even that, because I remember that experience even today. And I remember the shoulder pads and the pinstripe. And I remember, you know, how they would go onto the trading floor. And I remember the rivalry. I remember all of it. But the thing that really stands out for me was just the unashamed assertion of femininity and power, confidence, all of those things combined. If you look at other people, perhaps people that you went to school with, even people you went to university with, who won't necessarily have had the same experiences and opportunities that have been presented to you, why can't you be satisfied? I started to have that feeling. Like if anybody else that was in this role, in this firm, and could see, okay, well, it might be a bit challenging, but you know, I'm going to work through these challenges and I'm going to try and toe the company line and I'm going to do what I need to do to progress to the next level. Why is that not good enough for you? And I really had to reflect, you know, coming to the end of my 20s, what is the thing, what is like the, I don't know, the pebble in your shoe that means that you can't settle, you can't relax? And I started to realize that it's because you feel straitjacketed. And I started to feel like the corporate straitjacket wasn't for me. And that if I fast forwarded into the future, 30 years time, what kind of person would I be after 30 years of being in the straitjacket that I already knew was stifling me? And I think that was what led me to say, you maybe need to explore the idea of running your own business a bit further, which led me to the decision to do an MBA where I could give myself the breathing space, get access to people that were running their own business too, in order to decide, is this something that could really work for you?
Rain check. So just thinking about that as a business, but many people would say that, look, there's loads of financial platforms out there. And none of these financial platforms are, you know, gender neutral, right? What would you say to that? You know, why is there such a need? Why is there a gap in the market for Raincheck?
Now, if you look at the fact that the gender investing gap exists, there's this huge chasm between men and women when it comes to our propensity to save and invest. When it comes to retirement saving, in today's world, there shouldn't be a situation in which women who should take time out of the workforce, perhaps to have children, perhaps to care for elderly relatives, should be penalised as a result of that, leaving this massive hole in their retirement savings. It shouldn't be the case that when you look at, you know, the mainstream media and the types of content that are produced targeting men and women, that you've got content targeting women talking about how to save a tenner off your Ocado shopping bill. And for men, you're talking about how to build your real estate portfolio. All of these things combined have created a perfect storm within which women are completely, disenfranchised to some extent. We are disengaged from the mainstream financial services industry. There is evidence that some women have had experiences with financial advisors where they felt that they have been patronized. Or, you know, if you look at the financial advice industry in this country, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it is largely older and male. And if you are a young woman, whether you're successful or not, you know, financially, if you're a young woman that's seeking financial guidance, how easy is it for you to relate to someone that actually would have no understanding of your ambitions and the things that you were trying to strive towards? So I think the gap for a proposition like Raincheck is clear as far as I'm concerned. There are women that speak to me all the time that say, you know, it's really refreshing to have somebody that clearly has the background and the understanding of what the needs might be in terms of the, you know, the target, you know, customer base, and can therefore present it to them in a way that's relatable and fresh and completely plain English. You know, Starling Bank did a study a few years ago, which was called Make Money Equal. And in that study, you know, they talked about exactly what I've described, which is how men and women are spoken to when it comes to money, and the difference is really striking. So I really think that, you know, the industry has got a lot of work to do.
You never come across as somebody who is indecisive in any way whatsoever. How do you find that ability to be so decisive?
You know, I think to be honest, part of it comes from being quite a clumsy child. And I think the reason why that's important, honest to God, the reason why that's important is because I'm the child who, and the things that I've broken in my life just by tripping over my own feet or crashing headfirst into things, as a result of that clumsiness and breaking things all the time, I don't have shame in the same way as other people might. I don't think if I try that thing and it fails, everybody's going to be looking at me. I always think, why would you be looking at me? Because surely you must have your own situation to deal with over here. So I don't have the same, you know, quite often if you listen to any confidence coaches or people that talk about imposter syndrome, or you know, they always say, when you're thinking about not trying to do things, quite often it's because you're afraid of the judgment of others. I don't have that fear. I never worry about the judgment of others. I always think, if I want to try something, I'm going to go ahead and try it. And actually, if I should fall flat on my face, I have fallen flat on my face so many times growing up, literally, that there is, you know, in a more metaphorical, figurative sense, I've already cultivated the resilience that comes from trying things, it not working out. Mm-hmm. But because I've, you know, again, a contrasting character trait, which is my supreme willfulness and obstinacy, as my grandmother would say, that means I'm so determined. Once I've set my mind to doing something, I'm going to do the thing, even if others might say, I don't really think that's the right path for you. Now, unless it doesn't mean that I am completely closed to feedback or advice, because there are people that I trust and I will always solicit their opinion, always. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm bound to their opinion. And I think, you know, when I talk about personal responsibility when it comes to women and their finances, it comes from that innate desire to help people unlock and to recognize you have agency in your own life. So you don't need to outsource responsibility for things that you do to other people. You don't need to look over here and wait for the validation of somebody else. If I do something and somebody disagrees with it, I don't care, because that's what I want to do. So that means I'm fully ready to accept the repercussions of that if it goes wrong.
What advice would you then give to somebody who is trying to get that career film?
We have to think, who are we trying to please? And I don't say that flippantly, but I really think quite often it's important for everybody to understand their own motivations. And it doesn't necessarily mean that everything that you do has to be born from an individualistic, selfish place. Like, if it doesn't satisfy me, then I'm not going to do it. Of course, that's not really how society works. But I do think that we can easily become trapped in the expectations of other people or in the expectations of our peer group, that we see other people doing things. And so it locks us into these jails that we feel are inescapable. And I would encourage anybody to, if they're feeling this sense of unfulfillment, to really pause and give themselves the breathing space to reflect on, how did I arrive here? So for all of the decisions that I have made, good or bad, I can pinpoint to some degree how I've arrived in those situations and how to get myself out of them. And I think it's when people lose the ability to do that, that they can enter unhappiness and dissatisfaction.
So talking about decisiveness and career fulfillment, what's next for the Ringer Tomlinson?
I think a show. As much as I can advocate and agitate for change and offer services and solutions to support those things, I would hope that my lasting legacy will be that people who work with me walk away feeling like I'm now in control of my situation. So even if I have a financial advisor, it doesn't mean the financial advisor's in charge. I'm in charge, but they are just helping me navigate. I'm the captain of the ship. And that is essentially what I want all rainmakers to feel as a result of their interactions with me.
And just how do people find out more about Raincheck?
You can follow us on all social media platforms, particularly Instagram at Raincheck, or via the website at raincheck.com.
Thank you so much, Davinia, for sharing that inspiring story with us. If you are inspired by Davinia's story, please do go to rollingstart.org.
www.thehouseofmusic.co.uk for more information and more stories that will inspire you. On the next episode, we are blessed to be speaking to Andy Smith, the star of Channel 4's hit show, The Circle. We'll talk to him about being on that show, but also how he navigated Crohn's disease to become the entrepreneurial leader that he is today.